hppodcraft.com.
Good day, PodCraft listeners. We have arrived at the comments show for June. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're here on Patreon with all you to talk about Amazing Fantasy Month.
It's time, and we're going to start at episode 546, Empire of the Necromancers. Jamie Britton writes, "If I Was a Necromancer is my second favorite Beyonce song." Pretty good. It's a little riff on If I Was a Boy, I believe, the Beyonce song.
Tara Murphy writes, "I got the impression that you missed the part where the necromancers found the least withered of the female corpses to have sex with." She's quoting here, "Chamberlains and princes of old time were their cupbearers, and stringed instruments were plucked for their delight by the slim hands of empresses with golden hair that had come forth untarnished from the night of the tomb. Those that were fairest, whom the plague and the worm had not ravaged over much, they took for their lemans and made to serve their necrophilic lust." And she says, "Lemans is oldie timey for mistress."
Whoa. Andrew M. Reichart writes, "Yeah, I was hoping for a bit more HP pod crassness on this topic." And Drix writes, "If we all band together, they'll have to cover it on the comments show." And wow, it's true. We do have to talk about this. So that's what Lehman means, huh?
Yes. I never knew Lehman was an illicit lover or mistress. I looked it up in the dictionary. How could I have gone my whole life not knowing this, especially with a close personal friend named Andrew Lehman?
That's crazy. Yeah, what's even more interesting is that I looked up Branny, and that's oldie timer for licit lover. For there's an illustration. It says, it kind of looks like Sean Branny even.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it says, underneath it, it says, "This guy's above board. Have at it." So Lehman, illicit. Branny, licit. Lover either way.
True.
I scrolled down on that to see the illustration next to the Lehman entry, and somebody had cut it out.
Whoa.
Of the internet. That's how deep that conspiracy goes.
Wow, what is going on?
I don't remember that passage in the story at all, though, by the way. So my brain might have protected me from it somehow. Did we just skip it?
I do remember it with the cupbearers and the stringed instruments, but maybe we read a different version of it or something, because I don't remember that. I'd have to go back and check the notes, but maybe my brain was protecting me from that horrible imagery.
Yeah.
Richard Horsman writes, "Greg Johnson was on an episode of Beef and Dairy Network recently, a weird-ass podcast that is very much worth everyone's time." Yes. It's very funny. It's sort of a news show, but it's not real. It's a comedy thing, but it's supposed to be like a beef and dairy news show. It's very funny, and it's on the internet. So I would say look it up and then have a few good chuckles.
Yeah, everybody do that. Now, John Hancock writes, "I'm with you on R2-D2 and his bartending job on Jabba's barge. He's a droid who clearly gets on with the task at hand and does it to the best of his ability." That's right. That's what I really admire that about R2. He's very mindful. R2.
Yes.
You know, I think he just is present. Whatever's going on, that's where he is. Mm-hmm. "Taking pride in your work, R2, that's the way. If it had all gone south for the heroes at that point, we could have had a sequel where 20 years later, he's still there. Best damn bartender on Tatooine." It's funny because one of the only things I remember from that very last Star Wars movie that came out was that they wiped C-3PO's memory at one point and then gave it right back to him a few minutes later.
Yeah.
That's what happened, right?
Yeah.
Why did they do? What's even more interesting about that is that he has a lot of trauma in there that they could have, when they gave his memory back, taken some of that stuff out, like him getting blown apart, some of the stuff he's witnessed.
Well, they wipe his memory at the end of Revenge of the Sith. That's why he doesn't remember anything about Obi-Wan Kenobi or any of that stuff.
Right, but he remembers getting blown apart in Empire Strikes Back, doesn't he?
He does. He does remember that. The Rise of Skywalker, people worked really hard on that movie. They made it. It's a movie. However, I have a lot of problems with it, personally. I didn't enjoy it very much. That was just one of many things that happened in there that didn't really make a lick of sense. I thought it was going to be some serious stakes, like C-3PO is going to make a sacrifice. It's kind of the death of C-3PO. That's huge.
Yeah.
Oh, nope, he's not dead. Oh, okay.
And that's one of the only things I remember, so there you go. Yeah.
Rafe Ball writes, "Chris wasn't too far off with his guesses at the translated subtitle of Necromantic 2. According to Wikipedia, it's..." Maybe you should say this, Chad.
"Die Rückkehr der Lebenden Toten."
Okay, which means The Return of the Loving Dead.
Yeah.
I guess too necro, too romantic, and necromantic boogaloo just didn't make the cut.
Nope, but somebody said him, I'm sure.
Too necro, too romantic.
Drix writes again, great episode, guys. I must say that I also was really feeling the Evil Dead 2 discourse that got going for a bit. Perhaps Evil Dead 2 could be a bonus episode sometime down the line. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. I think we talked about that before, but it would be too fanned out, I think.
We just love that movie, and I've seen it dozens of times. So
yeah.
I don't know what I could add to the discourse on it, just to be talking about how rad it is and how awesome Bruce Campbell is and how funny and scary and great it is. There you go. Done. That gets us to episode 547, The Sunken Land. Michael Bilecki writes, thanks for putting these shows out. My partner and I have started reading Friday fantasy stories and listening to the podcast together. Cheap date. Take care, yous. XO.
Hey, that's a hug and a kiss.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's hieroglyphic for a hug and kiss.
Oh, I thought it was that guy screaming, you know, the sideways emoji where he's like, his eyes are squinted and his mouth's open.
No, it's not that, man.
But it's a hug and a kiss. That's even better.
It's a hug and kiss.
Ali Sheba writes, my parents had copies of the various Swords Against Stuff collections when I was growing up. I blame them for my questionable taste in literature now.
You should praise them for that.
Exactly.
I wish those had been laying around. Eldritch Scary writes, it's about friendship this month. We tune in every month to hear tales of the friendship of Chad Fofford and the Gray Mackie. It's always amazing.
Why is it the Gray Mackie?
I actually got adapted and your fictional version of yourself got adapted.
Oh, well, man.
Yeah.
Well.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
To Sir with Lovecraft writes, Michael Swanwick wrote in the intro to the post-utopian adventures of Darger and Surplus, I once asked Fritz Leiber if it was not possible that Nuon, the world inhabited by his adventurers, was actually a horror venue, disguised by the fact that Fofford and Mouser, those most urbane of swordsmen, always escaped the consequences of their actions at the end of each story, to which he responded, everything I have ever written is horror.
Oh!
I mean, that was a horror story, sure.
Justin writes, S.T. Joshi includes The Sunken Land in his The Rise, Fall, and Rise of the Cthulhu Mythos as one of Leiber's mythos-influenced tales, pointing out the similarities between the ring Fofford finds and the jewelry made in Innsmouth, as well as between Simorgia and Roulet. I'm surprised Chris and Chad didn't mention these parallels, especially with the octopus shape slouched in a great stone chair, which would seem to denote nothing but Cthulhu himself.
Yeah, it seems like we did point that out, but I think we don't point that stuff out sometimes because it feels like a broken record. It seems obvious, but at the same time, it is kind of one of our main value propositions to talk about H.P. Lovecraft and that kind of stuff, so it's funny to not mention it as well.
Well, we did talk about it at one point. It might not have made the edit, where you thought it was part of the chair, and I thought it was an actual octopus that was on the chair.
Right.
The whole place was submerged, and there was all these like dead fish, and things were wet, and we weren't sure whether or not it was unclear.
I think that made the episode, but if we mentioned the Innsmouth jewelry,
no, we didn't.
That did not. So yeah, that kind of stuff we probably should have mentioned. But yeah, thank you for that's what the comments show is all about.
Exactly.
Frederick Bridell writes, I really like that we have established a shared frame of reference for this show. No need to stick with undescribable when you can say, it's like a cross between Cthulhu's and those scary fur sheets from Yovambas. Oh, okay, got it. Pete Williams writes, late to the comments again, I wanted to recommend a couple of things. One is a Dark Horse comic book of Fofford and the Gray Mouser published in 2006. It was penciled by Mike Mignola. It's a reprint of a Marvel epic miniseries from the early 90s, so right before he was about to start into Hellboy. That's cool. I didn't know that.
I've seen pictures of it, pages online, but I don't actually have a copy of it.
My other recommendation is Gentlemen of the Road by Michael Chabon. It's a riff on Fofford and the Grey Mouser. It's a really quick, fun read. I'm going to check that out. I like Michael Chabon a lot.
I do too. Levi Crane writes, you guys should really think about reading the first collection, Swords Against Devilry, with the origin stories for each of them, followed by the origin story for the dynamic duo. In other words, how they became friends. It's an amazing arc in three stories, plus lots of hijinks. I guarantee you would enjoy reading it, but also discussing it. The third story has one of my favorite titles of all time, Ilmet and Lakmar. Warning, these stories contain things you aren't used to, like boozing and sex. What? What do you mean? Oh, in our reading, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, not used to talking about on the podcast. I didn't mean personally. Yes, okay. Thank you, Levi. I appreciate that. Because I do lots of boozing and sex.
Yeah, man.
All the time.
Doing it right now.
Comment show 37, from the Goblin Cave to the Stars. Brian J. writes, Tinderbox is the best, so underrated. True.
Yep, it's a great album. Aaron Gullison writes, the concept of a Wi-Fi chipped brain communicating with another can be seen in the episode Living Hell on the New Outer Limits. I watched it on television back in 1995. That's funny because one of my only memories of that reboot of the Outer Limits is the Mark Hamill episode where he's using like virtual reality to get into a coma patient's mind. Whoa. So it's actually kind of similar to that. It's not the same episode, but that one was about scientific kind of telepathic. I think the computer ended up possessing the coma patient or something. Yeah. Mark Hamill's in it, so it was, you know, it was better than most of them.
Sweating to the Great Oldies writes, it is also in the black hole. In this case, a woman with a chip to let her communicate with a robot. Oh, man, I have not watched that movie in a long time. I don't even really remember what it's about exactly. I just remember I had action figures of Bob and Maximilian.
Me too. It was, we were pretty young and I don't know much about it at all other than it was kind of Star Wars-y and
yeah,
it was good enough for me, but it's on Disney Plus. I always think I should turn this on.
Oh, right, yeah.
Forrest Rush writes, I loved the discussion on judging stories succeeding or failing to follow their own logic and how often people who despise or look down on sci-fi or horror will use that to dismiss criticism from a serious fan. Mm. Yeah, I know what you mean. These days, it's likely to come up with Marvel or DC movies as the casual goer, i.e. virtually everyone, yawns or laughs at the comic geek for caring what Cap and Red Skull would have said to one another at their Soulstone meeting or how any of these standalone films could take place without all the other heroes at least phoning up to say, no, bro, can't make it. Sorry. Sorry, Bats, about that Bane dude taking over your whole town. I've got articles to write for my other fake, not fake job. But it was so good to hear you guys use Alien to demonstrate how when a story uses its own logic, its own established canon, it can succeed and further views can be even more rewarding. As much as everything about the Nostromo's first trip and the actions of its crew makes sense, we can only conclude that barely 30 years earlier, Prometheus time, people were just really dumb.
Oh,
those movies really reminded me of Waterworld, where everyone seems to be wandering around completely shocked that they're living on a, how do they say, a world covered in water? Waterworld is so odd.
But also, Prometheus is unbelievably bizarrely written compared to the tightness of the first Alien film.
Yeah.
Sludgecrawler writes, thanks to Chad for calling out the culture of mindless arguing.
Yeah, there's, I think what I was calling out by saying, you know, sometimes we're doing it and it's, what are we getting so upset about, I guess. But if I could talk out of both sides of my mouth a bit on that, because I called that out, but I also think some compassion is in order for folks. When we say called out, I don't want to shame anybody for maybe getting a little personally invested in something or even being a jerk. So this was my thought this morning. Maybe I'm, maybe this is passing. When you're watching, you know, puppies or kittens play, what is play? You know, they're practicing behaviors they're going to need as adults working together or hunting or what have you. But they're learning to do it in a bit of a safe way. So you'll see that the puppy might bite a little too hard and the other dog will yelp and then the puppy goes, okay, that's, I can't do that to him.
Yeah.
That, there's a point. Mm-hmm. And adults do that a little bit too when we goof around with each other. You know, for example, when you and I are talking about Matt Barisi, can he beat any dog? It's a totally ridiculous premise, right? But the fun of the premise is that I bring everything I have to bear on it. I go, how would I really make the case that he cannot do this? And I think you do the same thing in there and it becomes fun. But you're kind of practicing skills you might need later in your life if you were defending yourself in court or something like that. It's a function that play takes on and humor.
I want to stop and get into it, but I'm not going to. I'm not going to get into it. So many things to zero in on that whole thing that you just said, but let's continue.
Yeah, I'm getting off topic even within my off topic. But I guess what I wanted to say is, have, if you've ever been with a group of people, this happens when you're younger, everybody's cracking wise, and then one person goes a little too far, you know, cuts a little too deep, it gets a little personal.
Yeah.
In the room, often the reaction isn't to fight back against what that person said, but it's a little more like, whoa, whoa, hey. You're embarrassed for them a little because they missed a social cue.
Yeah.
Reactions tend to actually be kind of kind in a situation like that where you show them, whoa, whoa, here's the line. And it's almost a teachable moment. Gradually that person will know, okay, this is kidding and this is not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a vacuum of the internet, sometimes we miss a little bit of that. And so you'll go after somebody for having an opinion. You know, it's like so many comedians say, I had a rough life and as a result, I'm a comedian. But also you'll find in those stories, they also had a safe place. They'll go, it was just me and my siblings, so we cracked each other up. Or it was just us in the home. There's always a safe place where they got to exercise humor and make some mistakes and cross some lines. And in the absence of that, I think that people, they take things a little too far and maybe we should have some compassion for them because they just don't understand this is play. These things don't matter. They're tying it up with something personal and still learning what's real and what's not to an extent. So that was a long way around to say, I don't want to necessarily condemn people for tearing things down. I just think they're in the wrong place with it. And if we can all exercise a little compassion, maybe they'll get better at it. The end.
Okay. I agree. I think that it's okay to talk about things and break things down and discuss them. I mean, that's what our show does, for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. But have some compassion. Think about people's feelings. And that's kind of honestly the reason why we only cover dead authors.
Yeah.
I don't want to rip on somebody that can hear me ripping on a story that they wrote.
Absolutely. Right. I know. Because yeah. It really doesn't matter what I think about it at the end of the day. Yeah. No. So I wouldn't want to make somebody feel bad.
She, her, Shoggoth Lord writes, coming back to this, I think the argument about character competence, meaning there's no narrative, is particularly asinine because it can actually make the story more exciting. I rewatched a modern horror film called The Collector recently. I recommend it only if you can handle a bit of torture, porniness, because it does get gruesome in parts. It's your basic, figurative, monster in a literal house story, but with a novel twist. The protagonist is a thief that spent months casing the house, but when he finally sneaks in, it's already broken into by a serial killer who did the same thing. Both have detailed knowledge of the space they're in. Both have an advantage. The killer has trapped the house, but he also doesn't know that there's a thief there. And above all, the protagonist is good at what he does. He knows how to be stealthy. He can keep his breathing under control when in pain and startled. And he has good ideas, but he's physically outmatched, and his opponent is good at what he does, too. So you end up with a bit of a life or death battle of wits instead of a guy who just wins all the time. My point being, this horror and thrillers like Black Destroyer thrive on uncertainty. If you feel like the character could truly succeed, then when they fail, it makes it all the worse.
Oh, yeah. That's so true. That's a great movie, actually.
Yeah. You've seen it?
Yeah, I have. Even though torture porn is, I wouldn't call it that, really, actually, because there's so much more story behind it. Now, it's also good to hear you enjoyed it, because that movie was written and directed by friend of the show, Marcus Dunstan. And when I say that, he actually is my friend.
Yes.
He's Heather's good friend. They both lived in Macomb at the same time back in the day. Oh, so we were really excited when he won Project Greenlight. And he's an awesome guy.
Right. Yeah.
I actually did this scavenger hunt game that had a lot of Saw trivia in it. And he wrote like four of those movies. So during the game, I was texting Marcus to get answers to the questions, which is the most dirty, underhanded thing I ever did. But I mean, if you're gonna be a jerk that way, that's the time to do it.
Yeah.
You know? But that is really an elevated movie in terms of the genre it's placed in, when the storytelling is really excellent in it.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. I never heard of it before, so I gotta check it out. Alan Ricks writes, don't forget that AD&D creature of vampire moss, combining the most fearsome aspects of both vampires and moss. That is a thing. Now let's get into Black God's Kiss Part 1. We have a listener that put a sword in his teeth.
Because she did that in the story.
Yes. Yes.
And it did some manual labor, and we were laughing about it. So we got this email. Hi, Chris and Chad. Greetings from Sheffield. Just listened to Black God's Kiss. Absolutely loving it. Especially that crazy detail of Jor-El grabbing a two-handed sword between her teeth. Seems insane, but I had a thought. I have a two-handed sword, and I have teeth. Why not give it a try? Okay, my test piece is around 5 feet in length, just over 2 kilos in mass. Logically, I would have to grab it at the center of balance, or it would probably rip my teeth out. Mm-hmm. So checking that it is about 6 inches above the hilt, at that point the blade is 2 inches wide. So I braced myself and bit down, still holding the hilt and blade as I adjusted it to just the right point, before tentatively moving my hands away. And there it stayed. I tried to do a few manual tasks whilst holding it, but these proved difficult as I had to keep my head perfectly level, so couldn't really look at anything. I kind of want to know what these tasks were that he tried to do.
I got so many more questions, but...
Verdict, yeah, definitely possible, but not practical. Personally, I would have put the sword down, as it will take less time to pick up from the floor than from between your teeth. Then again, yeah. I'm not a badass heroine. Anyway, the wife is nagging me about safety issues and something or other, so better go see what she wants. Keep up the awesome work, Matt. Matt sent us photos. And I fully intend, unless I, you know, there's some legal reason not to put them in the Patreon post, because it was hilarious and the best email I've gotten in a long time.
It's so good. Jamie Britton, pretty sure the validity of boob armor is what Thomas Paine wrote after The Rights of Man.
Fighting his way onto the show. That's a pretty good one.
Jonathan Alvis writes, Black God's Kiss should be the name of a Danzig tribute act. Agreed.
Yeah, man. He was, there was some Glenn Danzig tomfoolery floating around the internet, because he was complaining, you know, I couldn't write the songs that we wrote then now. And I just kept going, well. It was making me laugh.
way. I'm going to cry my eyes out.
Ulthar Meow writes, 7 minutes into a 30-minute episode, and I'm completely in love with this character, yellow eyes and all. Yeah, a lot of people had that reaction. I think there's some Jor-El fandom newly reborn out there as a result.
Good.
This coverage, which is a good thing. Super yeah. Keaton writes, gotta say, was not at all expecting the turns this story took. And I wasn't at all expecting a Super Keaton in the comments. That's quite a handle. Right away, started thinking about a Super Keaton story. I thought, what if Michael Keaton had been raised in communist Russia instead of Pennsylvania? I already took the left turn on it. You know, instead of a production assistant for Mr. Rogers, he works for Comrade Rogers. What kind of Keaton would we have then? How would that influence his portrayal of Batman or Birdman or Vulture?
See, I went a completely different way with this. I was thinking Super Alex P. Keaton. So he would be like the super conservative youth character, not this whole alternate. Why is Super Keaton the communist Russia Super Keaton? Why wouldn't he just be more powerful Keaton?
Well, it would be more powerful Keaton, but then I thought we've already seen the regular... Michael Keaton is so powerful already.
True.
We've already seen the Super Keaton story, so yeah. I wanted to put a weird, you know, kind of bent on it. Modern comics, gotcha. Kind of exactly. Violent, you know. He punches somebody's head off. That actually would probably happen if it was hyper-accelerated. I'm thinking of Michael P. Keaton in that episode when he was on speed.
Yes.
If he had the speed and the superpowers. Mallory, he punches Mallory's head right off in that episode. Oh, did you see that one? Punches it right off. Nick's in there crying, Mallory! Gore just pouring.
Oh, yeah. Paula Wyke writes, I'm really enjoying this character, but I came here to address another issue. Did you know about John Steinbeck's unpublished werewolf novel?
That's crazy. I didn't know about this werewolf novel.
Ian Colbard got me hip to it, that there was an article in The Guardian about people trying to get this thing released, because it exists. It's one of his earlier things, but his family, I guess, maybe don't think it's very good, or they think it's maybe too pulpy and it would tarnish his literary credentials. I don't know why they don't want to release it, but I mean, don't they want some money? I would read it twice.
So when I looked it up, it said he wrote at least three novels that were never published, and two of them were destroyed by the young writer as he struggled to make his name. So clearly he didn't think very highly of those. Uh-huh. And this is probably grouped in with that. And it's called Murder at Full Moon.
Oh, God.
Oh, man, I want to read this. It's survived unseen ever since being rejected for publication in 1930. So somebody else said no to this at some point.
But he didn't destroy it. So that must mean that it has some merit.
Or he tried to destroy it and it came bouncing down the stairwell.
He didn't use silver.
Yeah, he didn't use silver to destroy this book. Oh. All I know is I did find something about the plot. It ends with a werewolf breastfeeding from an old woman. So we know that. But think about his, at least he's got his family to protect him, because almost all of Lovecraft's work that's published fits this description of something he probably would have rather destroyed, which is crazy.
It's crazy.
But hey, I think Steinbeck's reputation is pretty enshrined. We can handle some juvenilia from him. Let's see it,
on.
I think. It'll be great.
Peter Larson writes, also, this story should get a special mention for worst water slide ever.
Yeah. Or, I don't know, a reverse gravity water slide and...
But into hell.
You do end up in hell in the end, yeah.
Doesn't seem like much fun. Alan Ricks writes, you might not be aware of filk music. It is nerd folk music whose high point was the 60s and 80s. It's folk music about fantasy, sci-fi, weird fiction fandom. It's great, but not that well known, even though stuff like nerdcore is spiritually descended from it. Anyways, Jor-El of Jory has a banger of a filk song off no less than Mercedes Lackey's album Magic, Moondust, and Melancholy. What? I didn't know Mercedes Lackey did music.
Well, when you look up Jor-El, which I was doing because I was looking for those book covers and stuff, one of the first things that comes up over and over is this song by Mercedes Lackey and that album. Right.
Yeah, she wrote a bunch of fantasy novels. She was the first famous Lackey that I ever became aware of. I didn't know anybody with my last name was that famous. But isn't Bilbo Baggins by Leonard Nimoy, isn't that technically filk?
Yeah, it has a folk song kind of vibe to it as well. He's got a cool track. Did I put it in a playlist yet or not? It's called it's Music to Watch Space Chicks By or something like that. Have you heard that?
No, I have not.
Yeah, it's cool. I was listening to Esquivel's Harlem Nocturne, which is all kooky Star Trek sounding, and it went right into that one. Leonard Nimoy's got an album, but yeah, Music to Watch Space Chicks By. It's along those lines. It's pretty good.
All right.
Episode of 549, Black God's Kiss, Part 2. Peter Larson writes, I was initially repelled by the then she realized she loved him ending because A, okay, irony, and B, written in the middle of the last century, but C, ugh. However, your suggestion was that the price of the kiss curse was that the emotional reverse made it maybe better. Or in the weird, other-dimensional nature of the story, maybe Jor-El apprehended all the other realities where the two of them could have joined forces and had a fine time screwing up their neighbors. And so she saw those realities where maybe it's something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Christine McCain writes, oh, I'm glad the guys floated this interpretation. I haven't listened to the episode yet. Wanted to read the story first. Well, I finished it, and I was real mad for about 15 minutes until this reading occurred to me. It's actually well-supported in the text. Here's the conversation with Mir Jor-El Demon. I seek a weapon, she said, a weapon against a man I so hate that upon earth there is none terrible enough for my need. You so hate him, eh? Mused the voice. With all my heart. With all your heart, echoed the voice, and there was an undernote of laughter in it that she did not understand. And as soon as Jor-El escapes the tower, she realizes she made a huge mistake in taking the weapon as a gift. So yeah, I choose to read this as the curse being a two-edged sword, with a demon being absolutely delighted that it can torture her by letting her kill Guillaume, but in the killing, be infected with overwhelming love for him. Very nasty layered punishment you now love and thirst for, the gross rapist who assaulted you and killed all of your men. Plus, you also have to live with the guilt of killing him and the belief that you will never love anyone as much. So awful.
Yeah.
But way less awful than the interpretation that, ooh, whoops, she loved this creep with her whole heart all along.
Yeah, she didn't love him all along. I don't even see how that would have been possible. Not, I mean, unless there's backstory that we didn't get.
Yeah, I started reading the next story. She goes into hell and he's there, but I haven't finished it yet. So it does seem like she has remorse for what she did, that it was too much. And so that's why she feels like she went into hell for him. But I don't know if it's necessarily as deep a love thing or if she's confused. Like I said, I haven't finished the story.
Well, the way Christine just put it, though, that is, I mean, that's awful. If it's somebody you despise that much and then the payback for the curse is that you feel a deep affection for them would be a good monkey's paw punishment.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Patrick O'Whedon writes, given that the story was written by a woman about a woman, did either of you get your wives' opinions on the story slash ending since it was so conflicting to you both? I think I described to Heather what was going on in the story and she did the excerpts, but we actually don't talk too much about the stuff that I'm reading on the show. So
no, I don't. Rachel's interest and mine do not intersect on this stuff. And I rarely have her read anything from the show that I go, wow, this is really good. You should read this. Cause it's just, she's not really into it.
Same here. Yeah. I think Heather has been at some of the events before and somebody started it. She had to go, no, I'm not really that into this. Not that I don't like it, but I'm not. Not with y'all, you know, on this. Oh.
Rob Wilkinson writes, very glad I'm not alone in my distaste for the warrior woman falls for the only guy who can beat her trope. Also, this house has 3 bedrooms, 2.5 baths, and a portal to hell in the basement. It has a basement. Sorry, basements are super rare in Florida.
Yeah, he doesn't mind that there's a portal to hell as long as there's a basement. That's the same in L.A. Actually, good old Stuart Gordon busted us on that one because we had a scene in a movie in L.A. where somebody goes into a basement and he just goes, there's no basements in L.A. What's wrong with you? I felt really stupid.
I go, wait a minute. Yes. Oh, wait, no, there isn't. I couldn't think of anybody's house that had a basement in it.
Yeah, my Midwest was showing.
Caco Diamaniacal writes, has anyone written Deep Ones in Florida? Having a basement would be a dead giveaway.
Levi Crane writes, the journey through hell sequence of the story is weird in a good way. It reminds me very much of the travels of Michael Moorcock's heroes. They always seem to bounce from one weird event encounter to another, and it's usually pretty great.
We got to read some Michael Moorcock. I think that's going to be in our future. Maybe not
this Elric, year. Yeah, Elric, right? That's year. That stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Our last show, bonus 37, Mason Starr, spacecraft operator. Oh, Mason wrote me an email after I sent him the episode, and he wrote, thank you so much, man. Listening to yourself is really hard. I have no idea how you two do it every week. Which is so true. I was just listening to this month's first episode and thinking, man, did somebody calm down, Pfeiffer? Are you in a race?
Sweating to the Great Oldies writes, that was absolutely delightful. Thank you so much for putting this together, CNC Podcast Factory. And special thanks to Mason for general awesomeness and your contribution to the notion of nominative determinism.
Yeah, I try not to point out too much that he had a cool name, but he certainly does for the profession that he's in. Forrest Rush writes, thanks, Mason. I really appreciated NASA organizing the landing so that it took place in the afternoon where I am. I could sit back and enjoy biting my nails along with everyone else. Has Chris picked up his jaw from the floor yet after hearing about the utter lack of Trekkies among your colleagues?
Oh, man.
And Mason writes back on the comments board, I was surprised as well. I can't speak for the project as a whole, but my camera team just doesn't have any Trekkies.
Wow. My jaw is still on the floor with that one. I was just, I'm staggered by it. But yeah, you know, there you go.
I kind of get it because Star Wars is a mythology. They're all Star Wars fans. And mythology is in a general sense has to do with explanations for things. And I think that's kind of what gets people into the sciences. But Star Trek, you start asking about real human progress and get a little closer to speculative science.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's kind of like you and I won't watch any movies about dashing podcasters whenever they start making those. We won't watch them. No, it might be just a little too close to what they actually do. You know, like when I was a little kid, you couldn't watch any military TV show or movie with my dad without a commentary track. He'd just go, no, you can't do that. You could never get away with that. That doesn't work. That's not how the military works, etc.
I hate to say it. I think it might be an age thing because in the 1970s, Nichelle Nichols did these recruitment ads and they were super successful. Not only got women involved in NASA, but other people that were into sci-fi and black women. But it really opened up real science and scientific exploration with people that were fans of Star Trek that got them in. But that was in the 70s, you know? So those people that came up from there, they became astronauts in the 80s or 90s or scientists and that type of thing. So there really hasn't been a new Star Trek show. I mean, now there's some new stuff that's happening, but like, was it Enterprise was the last Star Trek show, and that was in the early 2000s. So
that's true. And those movies aren't really, to me, they feel more like Star Wars movies than they feel like Star Trek to an extent. They're high adventure films. The Chris Pine Star Trek movies.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're more swashbuckling. So they don't really fall into that Kirk has a problem core type of episode where you're exploring some issue of social.
Not at all.
Intervention or what have you. So, yeah, I think actually that's probably closer to it rather than my half-baked.
It could be.
Explanation.
Could be.
Jason Thompson writes, wonderful episode. You guys should talk to more people in nerdy fields. That made me laugh because I thought, have we talked to somebody not in a nerdy field yet? kind of the whole thing.
That concludes our coverage for the comment of May here in June.
Yep.
I hope you guys enjoyed them. This is just for Patreon subscribers. If it wasn't for you guys giving us your dough, your hard-earned cash, Chet and I, we'd be working taco truck.
That's right. Oh, man, I'm going to go work a taco truck right now. You shouldn't have said that. Whew, that sounds great. All right, that's all we have for this week. Thanks for tuning in, folks. I'm Chet Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories. Comment show.
Exclusively on Patreon.
HGPodcast.com.